on the ground and in the labs. My co-author on the paper is Ralph Stewart, who's the who's a CIH and a chemical hygiene officer at Cornell University. So, as I said, my dissertation was on academic labs at universities, but now I work in a research hospital, and the issues of safety are similar at both kinds of institutions. And this presentation will be a little bit more general about safety culture in institutions in general. So what are the goals of safety culture in practice? And they are to prevent injuries and to keep students, staff, and the community safe, to know regulations and comply with them, to prevent business interruptions like emergencies, like fire, flood, earthquakes, hurricanes, World Series, and so on, and to support changes in the organization that can respond to these kind of changing environments. So safety culture is a term that's thrown around a bit, and it consists of values, attitudes, perceptions, competencies, and behavior of people regarding safety that make up an organization. In an organization with positive safety culture, there are high levels of trust, and people agree that safety is important and that safety management systems are effective. This implies that poor safety culture would be one where people don't trust each other. They don't share the perception that safety is important or that preventative measures are effective. The concept of safety culture began to be discussed in the 1980s with disasters like Love Canal and Chernobyl and Bhopal. And in the 1990s, a Belgian chemist broadened the idea of safety culture and identified actually a danger culture and safety cultures. So, danger culture focuses on the past and is actually a default way of looking at things. Many organizations tend to focus on their past troubles and don't use the information to make proactive changes. And Rip found that in specific industrial settings, such as mining, risk cultures were based on oral histories of bad events, and these stories became part of the cultural identity of the workers, and he called these danger cultures. Well, the inverse of that is safety cultures. So safety cultures are risk cultures that apply the lessons from the past to evaluate new risks and prepare people for handling emergencies by, you know, thinking about, you know, how they handled things and maybe reevaluating how they acted in the past. An example here is this water landing, this famous water landing that people aren't actually used to that sort of thing, but commercial airlines have built a safety culture within their crews and passengers, and they were able to handle this event successfully. So to review, the default or danger culture is backward-looking, slow to respond to changing risks, and they focus on individual people's risks. And many organizations towards danger cultures. Whereas safety culture is forward-looking and able to respond to risks proactively, and it focuses on processes. So a story, an evolution of safety culture over time, we can look at the example from 1917 and the Radium Girls in New Jersey. So these women who were hired to paint the dials of watches with radium were told that it was harmless and licked the brushes and painted their nails and so on with the glowing substance. And of course, it was hazardous. And most people know these days that it was hazardous, that it is hazardous. Alice Hamilton, a famous occupational safety hero, heard of the Radium Girls and tried to get the factory owners to change the way these people were working. Because she tried to change the culture from outside but was forced to use publicize the issue using the newspaper to make people aware of what was going on there. Another hero of occupational safety and health is Glenn Seaborg. He actually won the Nobel Prize in 1951 for discovering plutonium. Why is he a hero? Well, he was also responsible for running the group that produced plutonium for the Manhattan Project. And he was well aware of the Radium Girls. So remembering the story about the Radium Girls, he put these rules together for how people should, the safety precautions that people should take in the labs that were using these radioactive materials. These are the list of them, and one of the, these look very familiar to people who are practicing lab safety and health. One of the rules in here shows that number five, that no laboratory should have more than four workers. I don't know how many labs actually have less than four workers, but he had an innate sense that this was it was dangerous, and it became more chaotic in an environment like that, and it would be harder to maintain safety. So these general rules are the rules that exist today for these sorts of things, except for the four people in the lab. So, if we fast forward today to the CSB and its analysis of the Deepwater Horizon accident, they also talked about process safety and personal safety, and they talked about ways, at the end of this little list here, I don't know if you can read it, it shows leading and lagging indicators. And specifically they noted that both the Deep Horizon and the BP accident in Texas City, there were ceremonies previous to these accidents that recognized years of injury-free work that immediately preceded these massive calamities. So, I don't know. Well, they weren't actually looking. They were probably looking at lagging indicators, right? So here, this is a model that I created for my dissertation and my analysis of academic labs. And we can look more deeply at the elements of proactive safety culture by looking at this. And the question is how to operationalize these elements. So my theory here was that in this model, management is the center. Management commitment to safety is the center of this sort of thing. And the values on the left are the way people behave and what they believe about their work environment. And the elements on the right are procedures that you can that are the basis, but both inform each other. Both sides inform each other. So the way to, as we talked about, to operationalize these elements of a safety culture is through leading and lagging indicators. So these are metrics. These are ways that you measure how you're doing in your safety program. Metrics that precede an undesirable and unexpected consequence, like a near miss or an injury, are better than finding out later. Then after what did we do right? Rather, is better than what did we do wrong? They can reveal areas of weaknesses ahead of time, and they can help people be proactive and enable organizations to take preemptive actions to improve their health and safety. So here's some leading indicators. These are things that are, it's a little bit hard to do leading indicators, but these are people who have advanced degrees, maybe people who have their certifications, the number, and it's also hard to figure out what's the denominator. Like of all the people in the organization, how many are PhDs or how many have CIHs or that sort of thing. So the number of new safety controls, sometimes you can do root cause analysis using your accident data, and you can take the you can look at an accident or a near miss and look for trends in these sorts of things. And instead of waiting till the accidents happen, you can act on similar trends that happen. So lagging indicators are the typical things that regulators look for. The chemical releases, the citations, the claims, worker compensation claims, and that sort of thing. So actually, I mean, in order to comply, if one of our if one of your goals is to comply with regulations, you need lagging indicators as well. So you need actually a combination of both leading and lagging indicators to have a balanced program. So I guess what I'm trying to say is to develop a management system that addresses both the personal system and the organizational safety, you need leading and lagging indicators. And you also need to identify leaders within the organization who can be champions of this sort of thing. So, do you have any questions? Yes. Well, I think that one issue is that the characteristic of companies are changing. A lot of things. There's not really everybody's in one big company. Most places, a lot of places, and they're subcontracting out. And then the control over things like quality or safety are sort of diluted out. I would say the thing that I've found in both kinds of the academic institutions and then the hospital kind of environment is that there's politics, internal politics. I mean, that's common everywhere, but, I think people sort of get fiefdoms where they feel like they have control over their own realm, and then it's hard to sort of you need some teeth in what you do. You need to be able to enforce some rules. I hate to say it, but there are strong regulations. If there were stronger regulations, chemicals in particular have not very strong regulations. So actually radiological materials and everything have much stronger rules about who can use them and how they use them and that sort of thing. But chemicals, it's almost like open. I remember that one of the issues I looked at in my dissertation is people can just go use their credit card and buy whatever chemical they want. So it's really, they don't have to go through any purchasing or any vetting of everything. So it's really hard to, as long as somebody has a grant that allows somebody to have a credit card to do that, or it's really hard to control. So I think, politics and that kind of thing aside, I think that, unfortunately, there's a crisis helps a situation. I mean, it helps galvanize people and sort of refocus priorities. So, I hate to say it, but I think that helped. Yeah, that helps. Any other questions? Well, good. Well, thank you.